This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance. And I did not kill my wife, and you don't care.
I don't care.
And I believe I can fly, cause I'm the king of the world. From the 90s to nothing, I'll be there.
You be sweet to him, especially your wife. My husband wasn't sweet to me. Look how I turned out.
Welcome back to another episode of the only all 90s movies podcast right here on Place to Be Nation Pop. This is 90 to Nothing. I am one of your hosts, Russell Sellers, and with me, as always, is my cohort in movie watching, Sam Neely. How are you tonight, Sam?
I am living the life. I felt like I phrased that like it was going somewhere, but it really wasn't. I'm just living the life.
You know what? That's good enough. You know,
that's
all we can do. We just have to keep right on living. And that's kind of a theme of the movie that we're going to talk about today, because we teased the people that we were going to be watching a movie that neither of us had seen in our previous episode, but we didn't tell them what it was. So
we pretty much told them what it was.
Yeah, I think we kind of we hinted around what it was going to be.
We said it was a woman-led road trip movie. I think that kind of...
Yeah, it kind of lets the cat out of the bag, I guess. Yeah, folks, we're talking about that 1991 classic, Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise.
Now,
so, yeah, you hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen it. I don't know how much you knew about it going into it. Like, I literally... I'm going to go ahead and major spoiler, because there's literally two things that I knew about this movie. One, they did crimes. Two, they drive off a cliff at the end.
That's about my knowledge of it. Going in,
I did not know it was directed by Ridley Scott.
Oh, okay.
Did not know any of the rest of the cast. I knew that it was Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis, but I did not know which one was Thelma and which one was Louise going into it. And I thought they were sisters.
Ah, no. I did know that it was a movie about two friends and the whole, like, the cliff thing at the end. And the reason I knew about the cliff thing at the end is because it's been parodied in other movies.
I first learned about it from Whose Line Is It Anyway, way back in the day.
I first learned about it from Wayne's World 2, because one of the many endings of that movie is the Thelma and Louise ending.
Yeah.
Where Wayne and Garth are dressed kind of like the two and they drive off a cliff. But then they decide in mid-fall to do the super happy mega ending or something like that. But yeah, that was about my knowledge of it. I knew Ridley Scott directed this one, and it seemed a little different for him, because I thought of him as, like, oh, the guy that directed Alien and Gladiator. You know, those are the...
Yeah, those are the two that I think of when I think of Ridley Scott.
Yeah, kind of. That's where my mind goes. But watching this movie, it's very different from anything else I think he's done. And overall, I really enjoyed this movie a lot.
I did too. It was, you know, it was not what I expected, but it's also, I think there's a quality to some of the early 90s movies where you don't realize how invested you are in the characters until you're suddenly super invested in the characters.
Yeah, this movie kind of sneaks up on you in that way, because I watched this movie about three or four times before we finally got to recording this episode.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched it, maybe I was distracted or something, because I just, I wasn't really in it, I guess, in the first act. Like, it was taking a minute for me to really feel engaged in the movie. And some of the stuff that was happening felt like it just kind of came out of nowhere. Like, I guess I just completely missed the part where they mentioned Susan Sarandon's character having a boyfriend, because suddenly Michael Madsen just kind of shows up, and I'm like, okay, who's this?
And yeah, they mentioned him a few times, but they also said that, like, it was kind of on the outs.
Yeah. This is a movie that demands your attention.
Yeah, you can't be playing games on your phone.
You cannot be like screwing around doing anything else. And that's kind of par for the course of Ridley Scott movies. When he's trying to tell a story, he expects you to pay attention. And that is something that this movie definitely requires of its audience. You must pay attention to even the little bits of dialogue that are thrown in there, because there's lots of little things that you may not think are important, but they actually are for character development, or just for, like in my case here, introducing a character who's going to be important later.
Yeah.
So, pretty strong performances top to bottom in this one, but I guess for the people that haven't seen it, I guess we should kind of give them at least a little bit of plot here, because I was like you. I went into this movie not really knowing how all of this started. Like, how did these two women wind up running from police? And it's really kind of a Me Too movie before that was a thing.
It is, but at the same time, it's also kind of a trope. It's kind of a, oh, well, let's just use a trope movie.
In its way.
And I only say that, I only say that because of the way that the scene is shot.
Yeah, those are difficult scenes to film, though. And the scene we're talking about is, to give a little background, Thelma is a bored, lonely,
unhappy housewife.
Very unhappy housewife in a small town in Arkansas.
Which, if your husband is Christopher McDonald in a 90s movie, he always played a douchebag. So that's perfectly understandable.
He never not played a douchebag in anything that I've seen him in.
I'm pretty sure that... Yeah, that goes for me too.
I mean, he's Shooter McGavin in Happy Gilmore, and he's
the guy with the dog in Dirty Work.
Yep, and he's Elijah Wood's dad in The Faculty. Very small bit
he's
there.
He's actually in Boardwalk Empire, even going up to more recent years. In Boardwalk Empire, he plays, I don't remember the character's name, he's an actual historical character, but one of the things he did was arrange for women for President Warren G. Harding.
So this guy's pretty much trash all the way around. He's probably a really nice guy. Yeah. But
I hope so, because if you make your money being that trash, you better be a good person in real life.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope for his sake that he's actually a nice person. He's actually a really nice guy. He just plays a douchebag in every movie. But
he's got that face.
And man, is his face punchable in this movie.
Because he's got that mustache.
He's doing his best Ron Jeremy look, and I mean, he works as a regional manager for a car dealership, and dear God, is he an asshole. I mean, just, he's terrible to Thelma pretty much from the jump, and if you're looking at that situation from the outside, here's his, like, 5'10", like, peak Gina Davis, and it just makes no sense. It's like...
And then he also turns around and starts being shitty to the remodelers that are outside the house just for no reason. He's like, I'm an asshole. Look at me.
He totally slips on their stuff and, like, falls on his ass. And as it turns out, that was not in the script.
Was it not?
No, he actually legit tripped. And Ridley Scott thought the scene was so funny that they kept it in the movie. That's another thing about this movie, is that it has a lot of comedy in it. But it's not a comedy. It's not supposed to be that at all. But the trailers for the movie made it look like it was. So audiences were a little duped whenever they went into this one.
The audience would be a little pissed if they went into this thinking that it was a straight up comedy. But when you mention the slipping and keeping in the movie, there's a lot of little things that just kind of give you these indicators. There's as the plot goes, Louise has a friend who is getting rid of some property and is letting his friends borrow it. They're going to go camping for the weekend. Mm-hmm. Thelma is afraid to ask her husband, and you even see inside their homes when they're getting ready. Thelma, Thelma's just kind of throwing stuff into a bag, including a gun. Yeah. Louise takes a sip of water and then turns around and wipes down the entire... Like, you see the difference in their personalities going into this, that Thelma didn't, you know, she didn't even tell her husband she was leaving, which he's a dick anyway, so who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
But also, you know, Louise is very, very planned and meticulous, and Thelma is very impulsive, and it's that dynamic that kind of gets them into the situation that they end up in through the rest of the movie, but it's also Louise having an impulsive moment too.
Yeah, it's like it's such a shit situation that they wind up in that just come like it becomes a snowball effect. Like one thing, just like one bad thing leads to another, and through a series of just bad luck, unfortunate timing, and also pretty much bad decisions on just about every character in the movie, they wind up where they are. But the event that kicks everything off is when they've, like you said, they've left for their weekend away where they're going to go fishing, oddly enough.
Yeah.
They decide to stop at this a nightclub, which is definitely a trucker stop because there are tons of like big rig trucks parked around this place.
Oh yeah.
And you can tell this is a real dive bar situation.
But you know, just like in every movie, it's a dive bar, but there's some high quality live music going on. I'm like,
yeah,
that's not bad at all.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. I'm like, you know what, country music is not normally my thing, but this soundtrack's pretty good. And this,
it is
the dude fronting the band was pretty right on. I was enjoying that performance, and so you've got these two, you know, friends stopping here just to get a little something to eat, mostly because Thelma was wanting to have fun. She's wanting to just cut loose and do things that she just never gets to do with her husband. So,
yeah. So
here we are.
She's on an actual, like, she's not just on vacation from being at home. She's on vacation.
Yeah.
She's like, this is vacation. I want to stop and get some drinks.
Yeah, and she's like, I'm going to stop and get drinks. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to dance with people. I mean, nothing wrong with that. And this, of course, there's a random, you know, douchebag in there, a guy named Harlan, who hits on both of them, but definitely zeroes in on Thelma. And make sure to keep supplying them with alcohol. And you can kind of tell that Harlan probably has a reputation in this place because one of the waitresses even calls him out. Would have been nice of her to kind of warn them away and say, no, this dude's a pretty bad dude. Don't get involved with him if you can avoid it. But that's where everything starts to go wrong because Thelma decides, oh, well, he's been nice to me, so I'm going to go dance with this dude. He, like I said, continuously feeds her alcohol, gets her good and wasted. And in a moment where he's able to separate Thelma and Louise from each other, he takes Thelma outside and attempts to rape her.
Of course, at this point, Louise, and it's already been established, you know, through the whole Chekhov's gun situation, we've gotten our rule of threes. We saw Thelma pack the gun. We saw Louise say, wait, where's the gun? Or I don't remember how exactly it happened, but they established as the reminder that, yes, there is a gun. So Louise comes, holds the gun up to Harlan's head and says, back off.
Yeah, she's like, you can, you know, back off or she's going to splatter his brains all over this nice car.
Splatter his brains on the fancy car, yeah.
And, of course, he stops, but he's already, like, slapped Thelma around a lot. Thelma attempted to resist him, but he was just way stronger than her. And if Louise hadn't come out when she did, he definitely would have successfully raped her. She prevents that, and they start to walk away, but Harlan decides to shoot his mouth off again and tells...
And then in a moment, then Louise shoots him.
Shoots him right in the chest. I was thinking, you know, you could have shot him in the dick, and that would have... you know, that would have gotten the point across, but she straight up kills him right there, one shot from a .38 to the chest. And that's when they get in the car in a real panic and just flee the scene. Like they're trying to get the hell out of there. And of course they're, you know, in a panic, like, what do we do now? And that's how the whole, like, running from one state to the next begins, because they do get on the police's radar. The police are now looking for these two women in connection with this dead guy that they were both seen with at one point.
The thing is, they're looking for them as witnesses, but also Louise knows, and she says, and of course, as you find out later in the movie, she has been a victim of a sexual assault in the past, but she does bring up that no one's going to believe you because you were dancing with this guy, which, first of all, if that's your mindset, like, if you hear about that and you see that somebody was dancing with someone and you think, oh, well, she's probably lying, then fuck you.
Yep.
But secondly, that's also most likely, it's not stated right out, but that is probably what Louise experienced in her own past.
I think so. I think that's what she was saying, was that even though she probably went to the cops, like, because she has this big thing in the movie where she doesn't want to go to Texas. She wants to go from Arkansas to Oklahoma and go around Texas to get to Mexico.
Around Texas to get to Mexico.
Yeah, that's kind of nuts. But at the same time, you start to understand whenever the truth is revealed that she was raped in Texas, so she never wants to go there again. So, yeah, you're probably right that her experience was she likely went to the cops and tried to plead her case that she was sexually assaulted and they didn't believe her. And the person who did it got away with it.
Yeah.
So,
and so at this point, though, you do start seeing the kind of the personality dynamics again. They stop at a hotel, and all Thelma wants to do is sleep because she's just processing. And Louise is already at this point devising a plan. She's like, well, I have, you know, $6,000 in savings. I can get my boyfriend to wire me that amount and pay him back for my savings, and we can use that to get out. You know, she's already devising a plan.
Yeah.
And then Louise is also just kind of like, well, okay, I'm just along for the ride. They meet JD.
Brad Pitt in his very first film appearance.
He was so little.
He was like...
I just want to pat him on the head and give him a sucker.
Yeah, he looks super young. It's like it's kind of weird, like, seeing him like this. And he's... I don't want to say like he's rail thin, but he's definitely like... almost like that runner physique rather than like the wider build.
Right.
But of all
the... That makes sense, what you mean. Or like the swimmer thing.
Yeah.
You just like, have no body fat, but not really any muscle either.
No, it's like, oh, he's packing the six-pack abs, though, because he...
And, that's true.
He and Gina Davis have quite the steamy scene at one point in this movie. It's one of the most famous sex scenes in film. Probably because... And not because of seeing Gina Davis. It was actually because of seeing Brad Pitt. Like, that was kind of what helped him become famous.
Yeah,
oddly enough, but that is one of the like more random points in the movie, because JD is a thief who winds up stealing that $6,000 that they got to help them get to Mexico, and that's really where the movie undergoes its next shift when. The character dynamics begin to change, and Thelma starts to become more of a take charge type, while Louise is kind of falling apart.
Because they stop off at a convenience store, and Thelma goes in, robs the place.
Yep.
Essentially using the same lines when JD was telling about the time he robbed a store.
Yeah.
She's essentially just using his MO, and comes on out.
And it's such a great way that we view that, too, because we don't actually see it. Like, when they stop at the store and she goes in, we don't see any of the robbery happening. She just comes running out and telling Louise to start the car and let's go.
But then you see it on security footage.
Yeah, you see the security footage while Harvey Keitel... Stephen Tobolowsky.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
like it's such a weird little mishmash. Yeah, Harvey Keitel is a detective with the Arkansas State PD. Stephen Tobolowsky is a Fed, and they're working together to try and figure out what's going on with these folks.
Yeah, and I really liked Harvey Keitel's character in this movie.
I did too. It's a very Harvey Keitel character. Like, there's nothing really out of character about him, but there's something about when he's playing someone who just wants to understand. It's similar to how he did in Reservoir Dogs when he played Mr. White.
And that's another fun thing to point out. Michael Madsen, who plays Louise's boyfriend in this movie, also goes on to be in Reservoir Dogs, with directed by Quentin Tarantino. So there's
some, and you've got Brad Pitt, who's done some Tarantino. He's got one coming out soon, but then also Inglourious Basterds.
Yep. So there are quite a few crossover actors here with Tarantino and with Happy Madison, of all things, because Harvey Keitel and I believe Michael Madsen also appear in a few Adam Sandler films.
I'm sure that that's the case. I haven't thought about Adam Sandler films that weren't The Wedding Singer in a while.
That's fair. But as we pointed out earlier, Michael McDonald plays Shooter McGavin in Happy Gilmore. So
that is, yeah. No, Christopher McDonald.
Christopher McDonald, excuse me.
That connection I definitely saw. Yeah.
But like I was saying, Harvey Keitel's character is almost like our point of view character, because he's a guy who, like you said, he just wants to understand what happened, but he's also one of the only ones who seems to immediately believe the story that the two girls tell him, or that that Louise tells him.
Yeah, or even that he just sort of, because it's not even like she straight up tells him anything. He just sort of surmises that. Because he knows when he talks to JD, he's like, you stole their money. They were going to go to Mexico, and now they can't go to Mexico because you stole their money. And it's almost like he wanted them to get away, because, first of all, he doesn't have to worry about it anymore, but also he's like, I just want them to get away.
How great was that scene between he and Brad Pitt?
It was amazing.
I loved that scene so much. He takes that cowboy hat off him and just starts hitting him with it. Like, he's like, you've ruined everything. Like, would they have robbed that store if you hadn't stole their money?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, probably not. They probably would have been fine. But, yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where, like, one bad situation leads to another, and
it's definitely a script that was written with the mindset of, and therefore this happens, and but this happens, and therefore, instead of just the whole and then that feels really hackneyed.
Yeah.
This is definitely and because this happened, then this happened.
Yeah, so one thing really does lead to another, but ultimately it feels like this is a story about two women who have had just a real, like, shit turn of luck in life. And up to now, they've just been trying to make the best of it. But sooner or later, enough is enough. And this is them kind of going on, like finally taking life and saying, no, we're going to live by our own rules now. Because we're tired of life shitting on us. And you can't blame them.
No, not at all.
And that I felt like there are two really just unfortunately stupid bastards who really get what's coming to them in this movie from these two. One is an unfortunate, I think, Arizona state trooper who pulls them over.
Yes.
He's calling it in while, they're already, wanted by the FBI for questioning in connection to a murder. And while Louise is talking to him in the squad car, here comes Thelma and puts a gun right to his head and is like, well, here's how, our week has been going, and we can't let you call this in any further, so why don't you come on, get on out of the car. And this tough guy officer who's been, throwing his weight around up to this point turns into a blubbering mess.
Yeah.
Probably peeing himself, and gets locked in the trunk of his car. But they did shoot air holes in the trunk, so at least he wasn't going to suffocate necessarily.
Yeah, and they should have left him a beer. Like, they were taking, they had those six-pack of beers. They should have left him a beer.
Those were his beers. They took them.
Oh, yeah, they should have left him one of his beers.
Yeah, maybe. Although this nice guy on a bike who is also smoking a gigantic joint rolls up on the car and blow some weed smoke into the trunk for him. I thought that
that's
was
nice of him, though.
That was a nice touch.
He's a good man.
I like that guy. I thought that was hilarious. And then there's the really stupid trucker.
He was apparently uncredited too.
He was?
Because I noticed in the watching it that he didn't have a credit, and I was like, oh, I must have just missed it. But actually, I was just looking at the Wikipedia page. Marco St. John played the truck driver.
He's real trash. Like, he's sexually harassing these girls every time he sees them on the road.
Yeah.
And eventually.
That's another situation where there's the three. Like, they see him the first time, and they're like, whatever. The second time, they're like, hey, remember this guy? And then the third time, they're like, fuck this guy.
And they're like, I mean,
we're going to blow up his truck.
He's real dumb, too. Like,
oh, yeah.
I was like, these girls, like, two complete strangers tell you, yeah, we're totally going to have sex with you. Follow us. And they lead you to a, like, remote, deserted area out in the middle of the friggin' desert, and your instincts don't kick in and say, huh, this seems like it could go wrong. And, boy, does it go horribly wrong for him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they give him one for it. They give him a piece of their mind, and, of course, he's belligerent the whole time. He doesn't think they're going to do anything. They shoot out his tires and then shoot the gas tanker on the back of his truck, causing the whole thing to gloriously explode. I'm not sure it works that way, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I don't think it does, because I feel like also there would have been shards of metal flying towards them. But whatever, it's a movie.
They were awfully close to that explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Ridley Scott did not tell them that he was going to blow the tanker. Because he wanted genuine reaction from them, so he just made sure that they were far enough back that they could detonate it and get genuine reaction. But the problem was, when they blew up the tanker, both Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon didn't react. They just kind of stood there a little awestruck. So
that's perfect.
So he had to go back and reshoot it to get a reaction to make sure to tell them. Perfect. He was like, well, shit, I have to shoot their reactions again. So that's why you have kind of an overlapping thing of an explosion happening in one scene but not happening in the opposing angle. But that is that's pretty much, I think, the last straw for most law enforcement. Once that's happened, they're considering these two like armed and extremely dangerous. And Harvey Keitel's character, I think, called it right that they probably weren't going to be bringing them in alive.
Yeah, they have a great chase scene through the desert.
They really did. I loved that part.
Yeah, like especially going underneath the pipe, because they're in that T-bird.
Yeah,
and they're able to get it under, and then the police cruisers aren't.
Nope. Police cruiser tries to go under that same little like low bridge and gets stuck.
Yep. So they pull up to the edge of the Grand Canyon.
What a beautiful shot of it too. This is something that this movie deserves a lot of credit for, the cinematography.
Oh, definitely. And that's a hard thing to capture too, because like, I went a few years ago, like maybe 4 years ago, for my first time, went to the Grand Canyon. I was like, wow, none of the pictures really capture this. But this movie, I think, came closest.
Yeah, I've never been to the Grand Canyon, but just watching all the scenery that they shoot in this movie, I very much appreciated that they did everything on location. There are no, like, sound stages in this.
Yeah.
Everything is done on location in small towns or like small little deserted areas out in, it was a variety of places. I know they shot, I think they shot some of this in Australia, but there are other places where they definitely shot like very much in the U.S. I mean, the Grand Canyon's legit.
Oh.
Just some beautiful scenery. I mean, Ridley Scott is known for that. We've seen it in movies like Blade Runner and Alien, Gladiator, things like that, but this was just like gorgeous location shooting and very smartly done, I thought. Now, it's like the scenery, it's like the road itself kind of becomes a character in the movie.
It does. And the lighting, I think, the way that the lighting and the coloring is too, it feels, it's not just like you're on location in the desert, it feels like you're in the desert. You look at their skin and their clothing and the dust and everything, it's like, yeah, they're in the desert.
Yeah, it's like it feels authentic, and that's something that a lot of movies really can miss whenever they're trying to do something like this. Whenever you're trying to tell this kind of story, is you can lose some of that when you're doing soundstage shooting or whenever you're using like an excess amount of makeup to try and make it look legitimate. But but no, that's not the case here. Everything feels very real. Like, this is a situation that feels like it could authentically go down if all these circumstances occur as they do here. Now, this movie has one other very interesting distinction, and that both Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon were nominated for Best Actress at the Academy Awards when this movie came out.
Yeah.
And neither of them won it because Silence of the Lambs came out that year. So Jodie Foster won. Ridley Scott was nominated for Best Director but also lost out to the director of Silence of the Lambs. But this movie did win Best Original Screenplay. And,
yep.
I think that might have been the only award it got.
That's the only Oscar that it got.
The only Oscar that it picked
there
up.
It was nominated for cinematography as well, and film editing.
Ah, okay. It grabbed. excuse me.
It did
several.
Get best motion picture for the Golden Globes, but. Does that really count?
it's debatable. But, if you got to lose out to a movie, Silence of the Lambs, that's not losing out so bad, I guess.
Oh, no, not at all.
Quick comparison of Southern accents. Who had the most believable one, Jodie Foster, Gina Davis, or Susan Sarandon?
Oh, between the three? Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. Hers feels very authentic. Mm-hmm. I don't want to criticize Gina Davis's Southern accent too much because I do know women who talk like that, but usually only when they're very like riled up or upset about something does it like get that.
Yeah, hers. Thick. I mean, Jodie Foster's was not a great Southern accent, but no. She was a good actor. Other than that, in Silence. This is not Silence of the Lambs episode, but still
no. but just looking at these three women who were nominated for Best Actress, all of them having to put on Southern accents.
Isn't Susan Sarandon from the South?
I think so. I think that might actually be legit.
Because I always think of The Client, and she's got that very, very Memphis sound.
She was born in New York, so that might... Or might not be the case.
Then I just made that up.
Well, that's what we do on the show.
I was so impressed by her accent that I just assumed she was from the South. She's got a better Southern accent than I do.
Some people can really put on that Southern accent and make it feel legit, even if they're not necessarily Southern. Yeah. Brad Pitt, for example, who really does sound legitimately Southern in this movie, and then again in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
That thick Tennessee accent that he puts on there is pretty impressive.
It is.
Now, what did you think of the score for this movie? It was done by a young Hans Zimmer.
There were some great, there were some parts where I wasn't actually sure if it was even a score or if it was just an instrumental version of a song. Like, I liked that he used that kind of that steel guitar kind of sound.
Yeah.
And did that country solo at important emotional parts, especially in the end. Like, I noticed it most in the end. Otherwise, it was just a soundtrack that I was noticing. But at the end, I noticed the score more. What did you think?
The score at the end really stuck with me. I think that's when we finally hear... there are two sections of score that really stick out to me. It's the opening title sequence, which was originally not supposed to be shot for the movie. They created that because Ridley Scott loved Hans Zimmer's score so much that he wanted to showcase it at another point in the movie.
Okay.
So they created a title sequence for it. And then at the end, he has this really almost uplifting sounding score with a vocal choir in the back. Singing this really great melody as the car is going over a cliff.
And yeah.
That's an interesting juxtaposition to me because it's a downer ending.
I like to imagine because there's three movies. I like to put this alongside the other two. The other two are Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Grease. And I like to say these are all part of the same cinematic universe, and that actually the car went flying away at the end, just like in those other two movies.
Well,
that's my headcanon, and I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I watch Grease completely differently because I look at Grease and think of it as Sandy's dead the entire time, and this is her version of like purgatory and into heaven. Because she talks about.
Because I watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and the twist is that the entire movie sucks and it's a waste of your time.
Oh, well, if we ever start doing movies from whatever decade that one came out, we'll make sure to lead off with that.
It's bad.
Hey, I wonder if we're going to get any hate tweets for, like, shitting on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. No?
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I don't know. Let's find out. If you hate Chitty Chitty, I mean, if you love Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and I've pissed on your childhood by pointing out how bad it is, sorry? Not really?
He's not sorry.
I'm really not sorry.
He's like, I've never known him to be sorry for any opinion he has. Don't let him.
Oh, there's so no, because I've had some bad opinions. But normally I just like pretend I never held them in the first place. It's like,
There we go. That's the truth. Okay, that's fair. But
I was never a full blown Kurt Cobain conspiracy theorist in college. What are you talking about?
No, never. That wasn't you. That was someone completely different.
That was the hockey player Cam Neely.
That's him. No, wasn't there? Oh, that's right. You were. You had a collage at one point of other. Was it other Neelys or other Sams? And there was a hockey
other Sams.
Player. Other Sams. There was a hockey player. Oh no, in there.
There was another one. No, this was a. I had a collage of other people with names that sounded like mine, and it was just me and the actor Sam Neill, and then the hockey player Cam Neely, that's who also played Seabass in Dumb and Dumber, 1995 or 94.
Whichever. We know that's a
1990 eligible for this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. We are doing Dumb and Dumber at some point. Not our next show, but we will do it.
We will do it.
Because that is a classic. But now this, going back to how this movie was classified, I know I mentioned earlier that it was advertised as a comedy, and it's totally not. It's very much more of a drama, but there were several synopses for this movie that I was reading before I watched the movie, and it's like even a movie that came out in 1991, the internet could not agree on how this movie was should be framed, because I read some that called it a movie about two women going on a crime spree.
See, and that was my thought, like, going into it before I watched it. I thought that it was like Bonnie and Clyde, but with two sisters. And so I was wrong on both counts, because they're not sisters.
And there's not really a lot of crime being committed here. Like
there's the first one, I still say, is it's not technically self-defense, but it is justified, or it's they wouldn't have gone away. I don't know. I say they wouldn't have gone away. I don't have any idea. If I were on the jury, I would not convict.
Yeah, same.
That's all I can say.
Same.
On the jury, I would not convict.
I mean, I can't say what the jury ultimately would have decided in 1991, but I would have looked at the way I look at the situation is I think the evidence was there. If they had gone to the cops immediately, she could have said, look at Thelma's face. She has been assaulted by this dude. He was sexually assaulting her. Her clothes are torn. So there's plenty of physical evidence immediately that says this dude was attempting to harm her in a way, and her friend defended her. So is that going to say that you don't do jail time at all, that you completely get off here? Probably not. But it would have been a better situation than maybe what they wound up in. Although I kind of start to see it from Thelma's point of view later in the movie, because near the end she's like, you know, at first I was, you know, real scared about how, like, thinking that we should have gone to the cops, but now I'm glad we didn't, because I think you were right, Louise. I think we don't live in that kind of world. They wouldn't have believed us, and at least this way, you know, I get to have a little fun instead of having to go back to my shitty husband Daryl, who she's now decided that she was never going back to.
Oh no, yeah, and that's great. Like I think, you know, of the three quote unquote crimes that they do, you know, the first two I would say were out of necessity, and then the third one is where they've kind of gotten used to it. But also, you know, no one died.
Only one person died.
But in that third one, nobody did.
Oh, no. Yeah, nobody else died. The only person who died was Harlan. And you know what, fuck him. Even the waitress who's being questioned by Harvey Keitel after they find his body, the waitress that was actually waiting on Thelma Louise in the nightclub, she was like, you know, I always thought he'd buy it in a parking lot. And she's like, you know, is that, have you questioned his wife? That's
she's
who
surprised,
I hoped.
Yeah, she's surprised it wasn't his wife that did it, yeah.
And I said, that's who she hoped did it. And I thought that was very telling. I really liked that waitress. I thought she was funny.
And she was a good character. Like, she's a very, very minor character, but she's a really good character. Like,
she was. She was kind of the way she was hitting on Harvey Keitel's character a little bit made me think that, oh, well, these two have seen each other quite a bit. So it's making me wonder, does he come out here a lot? Is this
probably? I mean, if they're in the same area, yeah.
And I was like, is this place that bad where the cops have to come out here this often?
You know what they need? A new bouncer. And that's where you get my crossover with Roadhouse that I have, like, that I'm also working on. It's part of the Roadhouse cinematic universe.
Hey, Patrick Swayze was still in great shape when this movie came out, so yeah, he totally could have done that. This could have been the Roadhouse sequel we always wanted.
Thelma and Louise and Roadhouse.
There we go. Hey, you know what? Patrick Swayze would have, like, oh, God, he would have ripped Harlan's throat out in, like, one swift move, like, tiger clawed him to death. Would have been a completely different movie, but man, that would have been a badass. But no, I didn't feel bad for him at all, and I was just like, you know what, dude got what he deserved. I think these girls are actually have done the world a favor. Mm-hmm. But that's leading into our ending, which I got to tell you, the first time I saw it, I wasn't sure how I felt about it. Like, I knew it was coming. But at the same time, when you're seeing it happen, you're just like, I felt, you know, this weird sense of feeling down yet uplifted at the same time, because it was like, okay, these women went out on their own terms, didn't let anybody dictate to them how their lives went, even though they chose to end it right here. And then you've got that, like I said, very uplifting score from Hans Zimmer that just gives me all sorts of conflicted feelings.
I mean, I say, yeah, the ending, they're basically, they look at each other and they realize it's live free or die. And neither of them was really happy before. You know, Thelma was in a horrible marriage and Louise was doing fine. You know, she was working as a waitress or whatever. Like, she seemed to be more on top of things, I guess. But at the same time, she wasn't happy.
Now, I felt like I think they both felt like if they had survived, if they had allowed the cops to take them in, if they had been taken alive, that their lives would have been pretty much like over. They would have been imprisoned in one way or another. Like, they would have been imprisoned either literally or back into the lives they had before, which was in itself a very prison-like situation. So you kind of like, you get where they're coming from. And it's hard not to root for them. You know, I found myself rooting for them very hard to make it to Mexico, even though I knew that was not going to happen. And that's one of the downer things about the movie, I guess, is you have to just accept going into it that your two lead characters are going to be two people that you really come to care for and root for, and they are both ultimately going to die. So that's... Yeah. That's where I was at the end of the movie, but I also couldn't think of like a better way to end it. I mean,
flying car.
There we go. Yeah, flying car. let's do the grease ending. Car just like flies off.
Or they could do the itchy and scratchy and poochy ending.
Thelma
and Louise died on the way back to their home planet.
There actually was there was an extended version of the ending on the DVD release, where you actually see the car descending into the canyon.
Nice,
like it.
I think it works better with the flight. Joking aside, it works better with them going through the air because that's more symbolic of what, you know, of their transcendence.
I think so too. I think that was the right place to end it, and I like that it does that fade to white thing. And it basically flashes back to the like big friendship moments of their journey, like from the first moment where they took a selfie with a Polaroid.
How about that? Yeah, I have that old school selfie on my notes.
Yeah, I loved that. I was like, man, you know, they talk about our generation like we're the ones who invented the selfie. No, we didn't. Like, people have been doing that forever.
There used to be selfie sticks.
Yeah, exactly. Like
they have like a little switch to hit the thing. Also, I have to bring this up because I actually have just been winging it, not even looking at my notes. But I want that fish tank lamp that Daryl and Thelma had.
Oh,
like,
God.
It's a fish tank inside the lamp.
Yeah, it is. Oh, God. Talk about some very 90s things that you just that you see in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the payphones, you know, those
I have not smoked in years, but every time I do get just, like, nostalgic for being in college and being like, man, remember when you could smoke in a diner?
That's true. Like, there, everybody's just firing them up in this movie, and nobody bats an eye at it. It's just a it's just a normal thing. And, you know, okay, that's how it was back in the day, back in the late 80s, early
90s. It was, 90s, but I think there was also a lot of tobacco industry product placement kind of contributing to that.
Oh,
in
very,
movies and such.
And certainly in this one, like Marlboro was certainly paying for some product placement in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Ford likely too, because I mean they're driving around in like a 60s model Thunderbird convertible. And you know that's another thing I appreciate about this movie's authenticity is that you don't really see any like big like fancy cars even for the day. Like if you think about it, no new model stuff. Everybody's driving around in older model
Daryl's car. Is a nicer one.
Yeah, I mean, he works for a
But he's dealership. Also a general manager, so.
Yeah, I mean, working at the dealership, I assume that you're probably going to be driving one of the newer cars, but nobody else in the movie is. Everybody else's car is definitely older model stuff. Now, do you think this movie should have won more awards than it did?
Yes, but I don't necessarily... Like, I'm aware that awards are kind of bullshit anyway.
Fair.
So I'm not going to scream and cry that it didn't. But I think that it deserves awards more than a lot of movies that have won awards.
The movie's also, this was one that premiered at the Cannes Film Festival before it opened in a wide release. And... critically acclaimed, definitely made a lot of money off of the budget that it was given. But it's also one of those that, of course, got a fair amount of criticism from usually dudes who felt like the movie was being hateful towards men.
And, well, they can put on their big girl panties and deal with it.
Yep, that was my feelings too. I loved this movie as a
film. After reading articles saying that Captain Marvel was terrible because Nick Fury is shown washing dishes, I'm over listening to man babies.
Yeah, I can say that I didn't read any articles like that, but I do believe fully that they exist, and that's just...
I didn't read them. I saw that they exist, and that was the extent of what I wanted to know. Yeah.
My knowledge, my secondhand knowledge, knowing that they exist, I just dismiss that as a thing. Like, that is not a person worth listening to. They have no worthwhile opinions. And honestly, there were a couple of film critics who said that this movie was, by their view, misogynistic. People are going to see this in different ways. Like, people are going to see the movie differently. And for me, the rape scene is incredibly uncomfortable. And that's... I think it's meant to be that. It's meant to make you, feel sick and feel, disturbed by what you're seeing. And, yay, Louise shows up when she does to keep things from getting any worse. But for my money, viewing this as two women who are driven by a completely different purpose that ultimately does not have anything to do with a man, I view this as a feminist icon kind of movie. Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon more than earned that title with this film. I absolutely love how they're presented as two incredibly strong female characters, more than capable of living their own lives on their own terms.
I'm actually looking at some of the different thoughts on it right now, how many different people. Some people say some people say it's misogynist, some people say it's feminist, and the reasons that they give for each one.
I read some of the criticisms in that way, but I just didn't agree with it. One critic that I typically agree with, or at least when he was alive, on all of the movies he reviews was Roger Ebert, and his primary complaint on this movie was actually my primary complaint the first time I watched it, and it was the whole like fade to white ending. It felt like it just felt to him like maybe they were going somewhere else with that. And I guess I could see that from his perspective, the perspective of somebody watching this movie not knowing how it ends. Like if you were
right.
Like if you were seeing this for the very first time, you had no idea what was going to happen to these two characters, and then all of a sudden it gets to that, you might feel a bit let down. You might, you know, but I kind of wonder if maybe that's the point. Like Ridley Scott wanted you to feel sad. He wants the audience to really hate that these two women who like really took charge of their own lives to try and say, you know, the world had been telling them, you know, fuck you all this time, and they finally just decided to say fuck the world, that they don't get to win, or I guess they don't get to win in the way that maybe he wanted them to.
Yeah. They don't get to win in the way they've been trying to win, but they choose a new way to win.
Yeah, so ultimately I felt like they do, because they're not going to prison. They're not going to be like put in jail for trying to like take back their own lives, and that in itself is a victory, though one that, you know, is bittersweet. I feel like that's pretty much the best way to sum up this movie, is that it's a bittersweet film. And
yeah,
one that I think everybody should absolutely watch at least once in your life.
Agree, definitely.
I think it's very much earned that kind of classic. Like every American woman, girl, you should all watch this movie at some point or another. This is an awesome classic. So
yeah.
So I guess final verdict on this one is that we're both very impressed.
Yes, we can't answer a does it hold up question because we hadn't seen it.
Yeah, I was like, we can't say. I would say that it probably gets a yes on that, even though this wasn't our first time watching the movie. It didn't, like, aside from, you know, the aesthetics of it, I felt like the story's pretty timeless, and the performances and dialogue are all pretty modern, you know, even to this day. So, I think this movie more than holds up.
Okay, there you go.
For my money, this is one of those 90s movies that will probably always be good. Now,
I think so. It's definitely, like, it's, how many years has it been now? Almost 30, and we're still talking about it?
Yeah.
It's not one that's going to just fade away.
No, not at all. This is going to be one that people watch continuously from here on out. This is a true definition of a classic. So
that's right. And it's on Hulu for those listeners who have Hulu.
If you're listening to this within a reasonable amount of time, then check Hulu. Make sure it's still there under the 90s binge category. And watch this one.
I just searched the title.
Yeah, or you can do that. Watch the title or watch this movie over and over again. It's very worth it. It's a lot of fun. And it's just, it's one that's going to make you feel uplifted and break your heart all at the same time. So just be emotionally prepared for that. But that kind of brings us to an end on this one. So If you guys want to tell us how right or how wrong we were, you can hit me up on the old Twitter machine at Russell_Sellers. And where they find you, Sam?
They find me on Twitter under at Mr. Woodles.
There you go.
Hey, Russell.
Yo.
Would you say that you're a Thelma or a Louise?
Before, after the money.
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of personality.
Personalities? I think I lean more towards a Louise.
Yeah, I think the same for me.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not impulsive enough to claim being a Thelma.
And no. I think that I am that impulsive, but I basically had to force myself not to be. So I turned into a Louise. But really, I'm a Thelma at heart.
Yeah, there's. I think we all have elements of both. I think it's pretty easy to see yourself in both of these characters, which is why they're so endearing. Like we all have a little bit of Thelma and Louise in us, so this should be easy to relate to for most people. But speaking of things that we relate to, on our next episode, we're going to be doing something that we haven't done yet on this show, and we're going to be watching a movie that one of us really likes and one of us really hates. And that movie, of course, would be Empire Records. So, that was
guess. One. I was about to say, I wonder if people can guess which one likes it and which one hates it.
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, we'll leave that to
because we tend to like a lot of the same movies and hate a lot of the same movies. So
very true. Like, this is going to be a rare instance in the split. Like, which of us likes this movie and which of us hates it?
Yeah,
you don't know. I mean that could be the poll that we put out to people this time. If we wanted to do one of those, instead of you guys picking the movie, we're going to pick it. You just have to figure out before we talk about the movie which of us likes this movie and which of us hates it.
Yeah, let's do it.
So we'll put that out there as a poll for people to vote in, and we'll tell you how many of you got it right on the next episode of 90 to Nothing. So, but with that, before you check out our next episode, there's plenty of other stuff on the Place to Be Nation Pop and Place to Be Nation Wrestling feeds for you guys to check out. Lots of excellent shows on both. I'm not exactly sure when this show is going up, so it's hard for me to say just exactly what shows have aired within that time frame. Just go and check out every one of the shows because they all have something to offer you regardless of what your taste may be. So,
is the candy poll still going on the Place to Be Nation Twitter feed?
You know, that is actually still going on. I've been
like watching the feed so I can go in and vote as soon as they come up because candy is something that means a lot to me.
I have absolutely been all in on this candy tournament. I have been picking my favorites on Facebook and Twitter because
I need to get out there on Facebook.
Yes, there are votes on Twitter. There are votes on Facebook. Definitely take part in both. I mean, it's the Place to Be Nation version of March Madness, except we're doing the candy tournament. And I'm pulling for my either my Crunch Bar or my Kit Kat to go all the way.
I haven't seen my Milky Ways come up yet, but
oh, they did though.
Did they? Oh, yeah. It must have been today.
Yeah, man, you got to get on that vote.
I better get on that. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody need to go take part in the Ultimate Candy Tournament. This has been a hell of a lot of fun, and there is a tie-in. Podcast episode from Andy Atherton, who's kind of coordinating this whole thing. So go check that out. Check out his other show, The Great Debate, and looking forward, looking back, and the like thousand other shows that he has on Place to Be Nation. And we also we did mention the faculty earlier in this episode, and I wanted to say that I was recently on an episode of Freak Out Drive-In with Jennifer Smith, where we talked about the faculty. So go and check that out as well. And any number of other great shows right here on Place to Be Nation.
Hasn't I think Jason Sherman's just launched a theme park.
The e-ticket.
That's what it is.
That's what I'm calling it.
I definitely listen to all of these, and I'm not just asking you the names of them.
The poll may have closed by the time this is coming out, but I believe that Geek and Sassy will be coming up pretty soon with their annual The Sassies Awards. So hopefully you guys got a chance to go and vote in that. You can check out their Facebook page. If that hasn't aired yet, you can check out their Facebook page and see if the ballot is still there for you guys to fill out and send in to them. With that, we will see you guys next time, and thank you for listening.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. And we want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop.